And good morning, everyone, and welcome to another edition or another episode, if you like, of The Other Side of Midnight. That kind of curious time between dusk and dawn where the things that we would look at on, you know, mainstream networks during the daytime, or reading the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, and go, oh, come on. This time of night, you know, you take another look and there's other evidence and the world is not black and white. It's many, 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 many shades of gray. Well, I have some sad news to report this morning to all of our listeners in something like 155 countries we're in this morning. Gene Wilder, the star of among many, many extraordinary films, Willy Wonka, has died at the age of 83. We've been playing some of his music during some of the breaks in the last few days, kind of, I guess, presciently. Gene Wilder is one of those actors who personified the reason why the arts are so crucial to the well-being, the health of humankind, because he had so many facets. He was so incredibly talented. I mean, other people, you'd look at you know, them doing one thing a year that was a major import. He did like two major films in 1 year. You know, Young Frankenstein and Silver Streak and Blazing Saddles. And I think my favorite is The Producers, because basically I think that's what we're looking at in the election right now. We're looking at The Producers. We're looking at springtime for Hitler in Germany. What do you do when something that you began as a lark, as whatever, takes off and is wildly successful? How do you get out of it? I'm thinking now in terms of a mainstream explanation for the bizarre behavior of Donald Trump. I think Gene Wilder pegged it in The Producers. If you haven't seen it, go and look at The Producers. Pull it up. You know, it's on Netflix. It's on Amazon. It's all over. Take a look. I mean, extraordinary entertainment. So another great one has left us. It is a tragedy. Simultaneously, on this same day, the Mars simulation crew, who have been practicing on the slopes of Mauna Kea there in Hawaii, ended their 365 days in simulated Martian isolation. I think this is harbingers of things to come. In the political news, of course, you know, Aberdeen and Weiner have now split. I'm not even going to get into that. It's so symbolic and emblematic of the depths to which we have sunk. You know, that ranks as news. Item number 5 in Radio with Pictures is very important. The Russians about a year ago detected a signal, a radio signal, with their giant Raton telescope, which is something like almost half a mile in diameter. It's a very unique design. It's a ring. It's central reflectors. It can only scan a very tiny portion of the sky directly over the telescope as the Earth rotates. It's the rotation of the Earth that moves the telescope across the sky, kind of like Arecibo. And about a year ago, in a star system 94 light years away, they picked up something. And they didn't tell anybody. They sat on it, which is not, as Seth Shostak has told you, the protocol. So if you want to see Seth's reactions, go to link number 5, a SETI signal published by the SETI Institute. All the background is there, all the details. It's pretty interesting. I mean, I'm looking at this accumulation of events, extraterrestrial events. You know, first we had Tabitha's star, which is still waiting out there in the wings with a major radio effort to listen in on that place in October. Then we have this Russian signal, which is now being avidly pursued by the SETI community. Well, tonight, my guest is going to be talking about equally intriguing things celestial and political, because we're going to try to decode some of the extraterrestrial presence in this year's election, starting with the analysis of what Hillary really means when she says on Jimmy Kimmel she will declassify what's going on at Area 51. We shall see. We'll be back in a minute. You're on The Other Side of Midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland, and we shall return. I'm going red, my tongue's getting tired.
Hold your breath. Make a wish. Count to three.
Come with me, and you'll be in a world of pure imagination. Take a look, and you'll see into your imagination.
That's what we try to deal with here on the other side of midnight. You know, it's such a shame that all the lights, like Arthur Clarke once said in a story, the billion names of God, all the stars were going out one by one, as if the giant scroll of heaven was being rolled up.
Explanation.
My guest this morning is Ben Hansen. Early in his youth, Ben developed a fascination with UFOs and secret government projects, which, of course, is kind of probably connected with the fact that he spent his growing up years in the wilds of Utah. We'll find out about that in a moment. Ben has been looking for real-life X-Files since he was a child and decided he would dedicate his career to investigations. After obtaining a bachelor's degree from the University of Utah in sociology and criminology, Ben went to work for the state of Utah on a county SVU task force. His training and skills later brought him to work as a criminal investigator for the FBI. Although he never found the X-Files, never say never, Ben, his time serving at the state and federal levels gave him over 6 years of formal experience in investigating a wide range of crimes and national security details. He currently works as a systems analyst for a nonprofit group when he's not investigating cases, and it's in the investigation of those cases that we're going to be drawing our attention this morning. Ben, welcome to The Other Side of Midnight.
Good morning, Richard. How are you doing?
Doing pretty good. Gosh, let's go back into your childhood. Where in Utah did you grow up?
I grew up in a, well, not so small town, north of Salt Lake called Bountiful.
Okay.
And it was kind of up in those hills that I learned to play and fish and, you know, go camping and hear stories of Bigfoot. You know, later as I grew up, there were stories of UFOs, and not too far from my home, a few hours away, there's the on UFOs, and it's kind of reading ahead of my level when I was a kid. I knew it was a very nerdy subject, so I would hide the news articles and the books from my friends when they'd come over. And you know, those days it was kind of people would look at you funny if you said that you were really into the UFOs and believed in them. And so, anyways, no, I didn't really have any experiences until I was actually in college, and I had a sighting when I was on a cruise in the Bahamas.
Oh, what was that like?
Well, for those who have actually seen unconventional and very strange things in the sky, if you've ever wanted to really, really see something, you spend a lot of time thinking, will it change my world? If I finally do see something, will I be able to carry on with my, you know, daily life and not just drive myself crazy? And you know, it actually did change my world for about 3 days, because this object was in the sky, looked like a satellite, straight line like a satellite, but then it started doing S turns. Yeah,
satellites don't do those
things that satellites are not supposed to do. And
now, were you looking at this with your naked eye or with a pair of binoculars or something?
Yep, naked eye. I was out watching the meteor shower that was going on, and you know, so I reported it online and did everything that I thought you should do. And but you know, at the end of the day, if you already have an open mind, I've always believed it's not really a paradigm shift. You don't you know, you kind of already believed that it was possible, but it's an amazing experience. And since then I've had a few others, and I can't just easily discount when people tell me fantastical stories anymore, because I've seen things I don't expect people to believe.
So, growing up in Idaho, in Utah, the skies are incredibly clear. Did that influence you in any way?
I think so, because I live in Southern California now. I'm down on the coast, Huntington Beach.
And can't see anything.
No, we don't normally see things. I should say I had one of my most impressive sightings actually right here in Huntington, but it was only about 1,000 feet up. When you get out to a remote location, and the people here in the city just don't get this, Yeah, you see billions of stars, and I think it actually, my theory is it might encourage more people who are into space, who are into astronomy. I don't know, maybe kids grow up more thinking about those things when they can actually see the sky.
I can attest personally that growing up in the country, it was incredibly formative for me, looking up every night and wondering, you know. And when you live in cities, you know, people in cities are totally cut off from that. I think it's a crucial part of the human experience, and we're no longer in touch. So when did you find out that your own family kind of had a relationship to the concept of UFOs?
Well, I think my father and I discovered it at the same time. So when I was a kid, I was 8 years old or so, it was really the 5 years old that the movie E.T. had come out. And it was really movies that drew me in. But both my father and I just thought this was an interesting subject until I think it was about the 80s or 90s when the TV show Unsolved Mysteries started airing. And they would, you know,
That was in the 70s.
Was it that far back?
Yeah, he was in the Untouchables. Actor, darn.
I can see his face.
I can't
picture or what his name is. But
Em will save me. She'll send me Robert Stack. Robert Stack.
There you go.
Yes. Sorry, Em, I beat you to it that time.
my father.
Yeah, that was a Jack Maurer production.
It was. Yep. And it lasted for, you know, briefly came back recently on TV. I think it's gone again, but great show. And what happened was my father would sit down with my grandfather, his dad, and there would come up these subjects about Roswell. This is when, you know, the 80s Roswell story was coming out. And they'd talk about Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. Now, those who were, you know, into this subject know that Wright-Patterson is where the bulk of the material from the Roswell crash was taken.
Hmm.
It's the home of the Air Material Command, the Foreign Technology Division, home of Project Blue Book. And my dad started to kind of put the puzzle together because my grandfather worked at Hill Air Force Base, which was in Utah, and he did temporary duty assignments, TDYs, to Wright-Patterson from about 1965 onward.
Oh, how interesting. The peak years.
Yes. Right there in the middle of the Jale and Hynek, the tail end of that, actually.
Oh, my gosh, yes.
And
did you and your dad kind of corner him in a corner one morning over coffee and say, okay, Dad, spill?
Well, we tried. So he would watch these shows, and my dad would say, hey, Dad, you were there. Is any of this true? And he would sort of chuckle, and sometimes he'd say, oh, that's crazy. And then he started to nod his head and say, that's interesting. And they kind of had this going on for several years until my dad and I sat down, like, Grandpa's getting old. We've got to really start asking him questions. Well, long story short, Grandpa, he contracted cancer that started in his lungs and went to his brain and went through chemo and a lot of different treatments to where when I was about 19 years old, he was very, very sick, and he had changed the subject. Anytime UFOs was brought up, he increasingly became irritated and he would change the subject and say, you know, I don't want to talk about this. Well, we do know that at Wright-Patterson, he worked alone a lot. And in 1965, he came to my dad and said, son, I've been asked to be a part of a special group that when called upon, I have to leave the family. I can't tell you where I'm going all the time or when I'll be back. And you're in charge. You're 15 years old. You're in charge. And my dad said, well, is this something like a nuclear threat? Because he was a civil engineer.
That was a time of all kinds of paranoia. Duck and cover.
Yep, and we had a lot of those, the Cold War era threats, and he said, well, something like that. So he remembers the first summer where Grandpa got called. He dropped him off at the airport. He was gone for 2 weeks. He was given one phone number, He said, if you get in trouble, need some help at home, you call this number.
Now, where did he live at that time?
He was in Bountiful, Utah.
Okay.
So he knows that he...
So his dad would get in an airplane, kind of like one of those famous movies, and fly off into the sunset, and nobody knew where he went for 2 weeks.
Exactly.
Wow. And in those eras, that was not usual. That was atypical.
I believe so. And we know exactly on this particular date, he went to Wright-Patterson because my dad remembers calling the base because his mother, my grandmother, was very, very sick. She nearly died. He took her to the hospital. He couldn't get a hold of his dad.
Oh.
So he was upset about this, finally gets a hold of him, and they had it out. When he came home, they had it out. And he said, Dad, you weren't there. I couldn't get a hold of you. And he said, Son, I told you when I'm out there working, there's not always phones available. He said, how could there not be phones available? There's phones everywhere. And he said, not everywhere I'm working is above ground. Now, to this day, Wright-Patterson denies that they have an underground complex. I've talked to several people who've worked there, and they certainly do have an underground complex. Grandpa's specialty was, one of them, was maintaining elevator systems in hangars, the elevators that take craft several layers down, several right. levels down. So, long story short, end of his life, he is very sick now, and my dad had given up asking him. It had been a year or two since he'd asked him about Wright-Patterson and if he knew anything. He specifically said, Dad, I need to know, are we alone? Well, that conversation was put on ice until his deathbed. I was on my way to the hospital to go see him, but it ended up being my father holding his hand. He looked him in the eyes, and he was in and out of consciousness and lucidity. And Grandpa opened his eyes, and he looked at him, and he said, Son, I know what you've been asking me. I want you to know we're not alone, and don't be afraid. Take care of your mother.
Hmm.
And he shortly passed away. Now, he didn't give us spill the beans. He didn't tell us that he saw anything. But we, you know, knowing my grandpa, it's kind of a cruel joke if you were to leave, you know, knowing that the big question we'd all been asking, and to leave it hanging like that as if it was a joke. Hey, I know something you don't know.
Right, right.
He wanted us to know. And since that time, my father and I have gone on this quest, and we've actually, now this is pure speculation, but we have lined up a few dates such as 1965 December, forget the exact date, but it was the weekend of Kecksburg, Pennsylvania.
Oh, my God. So you're correlating schedules.
Yep.
When your grandfather was away on mysterious business.
When he was away. And
was there a major flap going on, a major something, like the thing that fell out of the sky at Kecksburg? Very, very astute. Very good.
So we've lined that up. We have mounts from Air Force Base with the UFO flyover that shut down the missile silos.
Oh.
He left for a couple days.
So what was your grandfather's background?
Well, he served in the Marines in World War II, and then he started in the Army, went to the Marines, and then in 1955, or I think 50, retired and became a civil engineer, a technical engineer on the civil side for the Air Force. So if you can imagine, anytime the Air Force gets any new project coming in, my grandpa was the guy who inventoried. He found space, workspace to work on the craft, to whatever they're going to do, the back end engineering, all that type of stuff. They had to make room for it.
Now, when you say craft, are we talking alien vehicles or are we talking airplanes?
Well, that, of course, is a speculation because of what we believe happened at Wright-Patterson.
So was he a mechanical engineer?
That was part of it. Yeah, his official title was a logistics technician, I believe.
Oh, if there was retrieval, he would have been a guy to coordinate the retrieval.
We believe he had something to do with that because...
Project, what was it, Snowbird, I think that's the name of it, or was it Aquarius?
I think it was Project Moondust.
Moondust, yeah.
Was one of them.
Always found that very telling. Yes, Moondust.
You kind of have to ask yourself, if you're going to bring people, now he worked alone, only knew people by their first names, and he felt it was very lonely when he was there. If you had a project that was secretive and you put people on special teams, you're probably going to bring them in from different parts of the country, because you don't want them trying to corroborate stories and talking.
Yeah, it's like the Chinese bringing in the army from the provinces to shoot the people in Beijing, because the people in Beijing won't know them, that kind of thing.
Exactly. So, again, a lot of this is speculation, but what we're learning about what he did there, and we're trying to find any remaining coworkers that are still alive.
So have you put kind of this circumstantial case together of your grandfather's secret life?
Well, I hope we haven't hit a dead end, because I hope it's like National Treasure, the movie, where maybe he's hidden something in the walls or
One of my favorite movies. That and the sequel. I'm hoping there's another one coming.
I love those adventures, and you know, we're probably hoping for something that won't be, but I mean.
So what was the most telling piece of evidence that your grandfather was really in on something? And again, if he wasn't, why would he be so chary, and right up until he's literally dying, and then all he says is, be calm, be assured, it's going to be fine, and no details? What was so secret that even at that moment he couldn't tell his own son?
And that's our question, because, you know, as you know, it was a different time then. When someone made an oath of secrecy, they
meant it.
Adamantly kept it till their death. Very few people. One who's a good friend of mine, his father was a World War II colonel, hero, war pilot that took a field trip to Wright-Patterson, and he claims that he actually held the debris material and saw alien bodies that were kept there in 1948. And we have stories like this that corroborate a lot of the things. Although Grandpa didn't give us details, the kind of, facts that surround it. And if you go to the pictures that I've got uploaded here, I think it's picture number 5, you see him... in the Army infantry, that's his picture when he was serving at the end of World War II.
Okay, let's tell everybody how to get there. You go to theothersideofmidnight.com, that's our homepage. Click on the Radio with Pictures emblem next to my picture there. That takes you to Ben's page tonight, the guest page. Scroll down. My computer's being very slow because lots of people are on the site. Okay. And you scroll down to where it says Ben's items. And it's what, number 5?
Number 5. So there we have Merlin Hansen, and that's his Army infantry photo. It says 1944. When he left the Army, number 6 you see there was him at Hill Air Force Base in the Logistical Planning Management Agency, is what that division of the Air Force is called. Number 7... is my father on the left, as he was about, 12 years old in that photo. So just a couple years before he started his special assignments, you see Merlin, my grandfather, on the right here.
Was that his real name?
Uh-huh, Merlin, yeah. We called him Merlin the Magician. He was an inventor. He invented so many things that he really, truly was a magician.
So,
very, very intelligent.
See, I'm trying to figure out why your grandfather would have been singled out to be part of these secret teams, and it's because he was a polymath. He was a generalist. He knew a whole bunch of stuff. He obviously must have been a Heinlein fan. You know, Robert Heinlein wrote a book, says, you know, a man should do this, 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 and this, you know, be able to skin a pig, you know, birth a guy, you know, mop up, you know, after a mob fight. You know, put someone in jail, arrest someone. He had a huge list of things that people should do. It sounds like your grandfather was kind of, we used to call them jacks of all trades.
Yes.
But it's a kind of multidisciplinary synoptic vision that you need if you're working on something where always the unusual is going to come to the fore, the unexpected.
Yes, absolutely. Until the day he died, he was always very, very good at creating things with his hands, engineering, you relied on him for just about everything. When you look at the commendation letters that he received, performance appraisals. That was this man.
Well, that tells us in part why it was him. I'll tell you, hold it there. We're at the bottom of the hour. If you want to join this conversation, you can Twitter, you can Facebook. I think I figured out where the term Twitter came from. You know, the conversation, everyone's a Twitter. So join us on Facebook or on Twitter, and we'll be back with my guest of the morning shortly. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland, and don't you touch that dial or that keypad or that device or whatever you're holding in your hand that you're listening to us on. We shall return. Blue skies. We're going to be talking about blue skies this morning with my guest, Ben Hansen. So, Ben, did you and your dad, because of your grandfather, kind of go into the UFO investigation business together?
Well, like I said, we were both already interested in it, but this connection that we discovered with my grandfather, it really kind of set something ablaze with us that we have, I guess, ratcheted up kind of, what we do in the field and our research and several different topics that have kind of branched off from this. And it's kind of a great bonding thing that I have with my dad. So when I go up to visit him, up where I grew up, I bring my night vision scopes. We go sit out there on the patio and watch the skies. And we have we've seen several things very unexplained. Together, and we would love to unravel the mystery in this life. I'm just not sure that's going to happen.
Gosh, just imagining your grandfather kept a diary and it's somewhere in the house or somewhere in a bank vault or somewhere. Can you imagine if he was on these cases in the field and they were carting off UFOs to write Pat?
Yeah,
dissembling them and back in. I mean, if he was in the middle of that, how could he not leave clues? Of course, in that era, when you swore an oath, as you said a moment ago, people took it very seriously.
They did. And, I think we have found little things. For example, he was really into rock art. So he what he called himself a rock hound.
Oh, he would have loved where I live.
And, so he would go out and he would collect anything from geodes, crystals, and he really became fascinated with Native American pictographs and hieroglyphs. And he had books and books of all these designs and symbols and didn't really, maybe we're stretching here, but this connection, he started creating his own little kind of designs of Indian symbols and putting them on rocks and replications. And he named his business Aurora. And he had a symbol, I think it was like a symbol of like a triangle. And some interesting things that, when Area 51 and, the speculation of these different projects were being discussed there, one of them, of course, is the Aurora Project.
Exactly, yes. And speaking, we'll listen to this segue. Speaking of triangles, how did you get onto the 1942 battle over L.A. with a floating triangle over the city of Los Angeles?
Well, that goes back to my days working on our TV show Fact or Fake Paranormal Files on the Sci-Fi Channel. And
so we fast forward to the film now. You're a professional. You've been an investigator for the state of Utah. You're out of a job. You look at television and say, wait a minute, I want a job in that crazy business called television. Is that it?
Well, I did kind of fall into it. I'd made a career change from working from the federal government. I'd never really worked in TV before, but I had an opportunity to get in kind of at the ground level with this TV show that they had pitched to Sci-Fi. And
now, when you say they, who is they?
A production company called Base Productions in Burbank, and they were fascinated that
is Robert Kibiot associated with them?
He is. He is indeed. He was a content producer for us.
I know Kibiot. I go way back when Kibiot worked for Geraldo. And
Yeah. Bob and I are good friends. I haven't talked to him in a while.
Say hi to him for me, please. In fact, tell him I want him on the show. I want to talk to him. He's a treasure trove of disinformation. And I mean that, I'm serious, I mean that in the best possible light. He has done all the investigation into what we're going to talk about later in the morning, the hoaxing, which I guess is how he kind of created this show. Because if it came from his fertile mind, I can now tell exactly how you fell into it, because he can be very, very convincing.
Yeah, and he's a great showman. You know, when he had the rights to the alien autopsy video.
Oh, my God, yeah.
I can see how someone would, you know, put that out there not knowing whether it was real or not, but it's a good story, and he loves a good story.
Oh, it's a hell of a story. You know, and it came with all kinds of weird symbolic backgrounds, like the guy who ostensibly found it or it was given to him, he worked for something called Merlin Productions.
Oh, really?
Oh, really? Ooh, do, 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 do.
So, yeah, Bob was there. They sold the show, and they originally wanted it to just be kind of centered on ghost hunting. And I said, look, guys, I don't watch a lot of TV, but...
No, wait, how did you wind up being attached to them? I mean, you have this whole investigation background, FBI. Did they find you or did you find them? Did you basically say, I want to ruin the rest of my life and work in television?
Well, we kind of found each other, and they did like my background. I wasn't, you know, totally sold on doing this for the rest of my life, and I still work for myself now and other things. But I said, look, guys, what I'm seeing on TV is there's a lot of these ghost hunting shows and people are just kind of sitting around waiting for things to happen. And what I think we could do is actually take the primary evidence of what people are claiming. Let's look at that first. Let's look at videos and photos and let's see if we can draw anything out of anything worth going out their location.
So a real forensic investigation.
Yeah. Yeah. And not just, you know, not against, I have anything against the other shows, but they're more observation based. And that's kind of a difficult show to produce, because if you're out there for several days and nothing happens, the producers don't like that.
Mm-mm.
So we decided, it kind of morphed into this, this show that was kind of a combination of Mythbusters with Unsolved Mysteries.
And I'm going to tell you something now. I actually saw a couple of the shows, and I was kind of curious as to who put it together, and because it was different. I liked the fact it was different, and it was evidence-based.
Well, thank you. We tried our best to bring in new science, you know, different ways to test things, and at any rate, my push was to do more UFO stuff. And Sci-Fi kind of wavered back and forth. Well, UFOs are popular one day and not popular the next day. Anyways, we took on this case from 1942 and the battle over Los Angeles. I had just listened to a lecture down in the MUFON here from Scott Littleton, who was one of the witnesses of the event. And so they said, look, we'd like to take a look at this case. Why don't you call up your witness? Well, unfortunately, Scott had just passed away.
That's really annoying, isn't it? When you want, sorry.
Yeah, it was really sad, because we actually talked to his widow, and I thought maybe she's just telling us something because she. I feel bad, but I thought she'd made it up.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was Bob who talked to her, and he said, "No, she was very sincere. He's not around anymore." So, we said, "Okay, well, what can we do with this case?" That's new. And
it's a cold case. It's 60, 70 years old, and your chief witness has just died. Yeah, what do you do?
Yeah. So one of my questions has always been, look, we have one surviving photo that showed up on the front cover of the LA Times.
That's the one with all the beams converging on something that's so overexposed you can't tell what it is?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And I'm looking at it right now on my wall, and I'm thinking,
do we have that in Radio with Pictures tonight?
I did not upload that.
Why don't we have that
one
in Radio with Pictures? Okay, send it to Em, and she'll get it posted, you know, because we got to show people. This is really an amazing case. There was actual hardware found in the streets of L.A.
Yes, yes.
Let's not get ahead of the story. So let's do this sequentially, because good stories are beginnings, middles, and ends. So,
okay.
If you can type and talk, so send her that picture so we can get that posted.
Sounds good. I'll look for it as we're talking here. So, you know, we decided we were going to do a few experiments, and one of them was we were going to
If I go back to the concept of the show, it was kind of based on Mythbusters, where you would take a scenario and you'd try to figure out normal, mundane ways to create the effect. And if you couldn't do that, then you'd go to the next extreme hypothesis, which is it was a real thing in the sky, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, precisely. It was unintentionally, you know, we didn't even think of Mythbusters when we put it together, but it ended up being that we would do about two or three experiments, and some of them were ridiculous, but they were great television. It was good television, but it made a point in saying, look, if someone had hoaxed this, would they have gone to such lengths to do this?
Would they have the money? Would they have the time? Would anybody have seen them? In other words, when you go through that whole process, when people say, oh, it was faked, most people don't realize how difficult it is to even pull off a stupid fake, let alone a good one.
Yeah, it really does take a certain individual to carry on something for several years as well. You know, and so this particular case, you'll see in this picture, which I'm looking up right now. We'll see if I can get it up. The search beams converge on something that has been the debate as to whether there's actually an object in the convergence. We have Bruce McAbee, you know, the famous photo analyst who had looked at this.
He's an optical physicist. He worked for the Naval Research Laboratory. I know Bruce.
He's very, very sharp when it comes to these photos. And he
totally hard science, total physicist.
Yeah, and you know, what I really liked was that he had gone to the UCLA archives to get their, what we believe was original negative of this photo, because they have the LA Times archives there in their library. Well, according to him, you know, he believed there could have been actually something in this search beam, but it's obvious that they had done some type of photo manipulation to the search beams. To clarify it, you know, for the newspaper.
In the dark room.
So they add...
By the way, for people who don't know what a dark room is, people used to actually shoot this colloidal gelatins thing in a camera with kind of pulling it over rollers. Then you would take it and do chemistry on it and develop a picture. Then you would make physical prints. This is for the whole digital era that doesn't understand what a dark room is.
Yeah, this was kind of the beginnings of what you would call modern day Photoshop. So, I've got the negative here. It's quite large though, so I don't know if I'm gonna be able to send it.
How big?
Oh, nearly 300 megabytes.
Oh my God! No. Reduce it drastically. You know, reduce it down to like a thumbnail.
I'll find you something that we can just pull offline.
Yeah, let's send something like about a meg, 2 megs in size. But for people who don't know this, that a major thing happened over L.A. at the apex of World War II, it's pretty cool what you guys have found.
Within the photo, you're going to see a lot of these little specks that were surrounding this, you know, could be an object in the beams. We believe those were mortar shells of the flak, because they actually shot over 1,500 rounds of ammunition.
Over Los Angeles? What about the fallout? What about all the junk that fell out of the sky?
There were a few people who died. One guy, he died of a heart attack. A few others died from debris in intersections that caused crashes. Some of the debris came through people's roofs. Surprisingly, I don't think anyone had a direct hit from the debris.
Wow.
But taking us back a little bit, this had happened just right, I believe, 2 weeks after Pearl Harbor. Or I'm sorry, not 2 weeks, nearly two months. So we're on high alert. Now, just 2 weeks before, Santa Barbara had been shelled by a Japanese submarine. They came this close to us. They tossed a couple shells at our oil refineries. And so the city's on high alert.
Hmm.
So on this particular night, they get a February 25th, I believe it was. They have a radar return that there's an object inbound coming in from the ocean. Now, they had at least two returns saying this object was moving closer, and so they called the whole city into blackout. They turned off all of the lights, radio silence, and sometime around, I believe it was about 2 a.m., the air raid sirens start going. So the witnesses remember, and a lot of people at those times, regular citizens were they had the duty of being air raid marshals, and they would go out, and their duty was to put on their little white helmet and to call in to report things, you know, in the sky to the central command posts of the Coast Guard and the Army, you know, battalions that were stationed around the city. So the people are awake, and they're hearing explosions after explosions, and, you know, anti-aircraft fire, 50 calibers shooting in the air, and mortars and shells. And
well, you've all seen the video of Baghdad during the Iraq War. It must have looked like that in downtown L.A.
And you can imagine the nerves of the people. We had just been, you know, attacked by the Japanese in not only Pearl Harbor, but here in Santa Barbara. So anyways, the long short of it is the whole thing, it's debatable how long it lasted, but we have been able to piece together that the Air Force had denied, it was the Army at the time, Army Air Force, had denied that they had sent up any planes to pursue this thing. They denied it.
Mm-hmm.
Yet we have many, many witnesses who said they not only saw our military planes chasing something, but they saw a silvery object. Now, Scott Littleton described it as a silvery lozenge-shaped object. And this thing apparently hovered in place. And
how big was it?
Very difficult to determine. I can't remember his estimate. You know,
it wasn't Independence Day size, you know, right?
No. I think we're talking, you know, less than, you know, maybe 30 to 50 feet long or something like that. And so I'm sending over a photo right now. What happened was they ended up the air raid sirens and everything had ended, and the people, you know, kind of went to sleep. And in the morning, there were descriptions of Japanese aircraft that had been downed. That later they retracted that story. There were stories of some other aircraft that had gone down. And then we have the legends. The legends are that this object, we had been able to track it coming down towards Long Beach and pretty much Huntington, where I live. And then it went out over the ocean and then possibly down towards Oceanside before it came down into the water.
So it did crash.
Well, we don't have anything substantiated that it actually did. That's where the rumors come in. The rumors are that there was a ship down there in San Diego, a naval ship that went and recovered it. So, you know, there again, it's anybody's guess if that really happened. Our show picks up on this and says, okay, well, let's go out to the desert. Let's get a lot of searchlights and let's try and recreate this to see if mortar shells and other debris we can put in the air would make it look and seem as if there was some solid object. Can we do this? And so we did. It's one of my most favorite cases because we actually launched a weather balloon or tethered it. And my other question was, what happens to a weather balloon? That was the main theory. If you shoot one with a 50 caliber machine gun.
I don't think it survives.
Well, it doesn't survive, but does it blow up? Does it slowly fall to Earth? Can it take more than one hit or does it come crashing down?
Right.
And turns out the thing just blows up. It blows up very quickly. And we ended up...
So wait. So you anchor, you tether a big weather balloon. How big was your weather balloon?
Oh, it was over 10 feet in diameter, which it was a vintage weather balloon from the time period.
Okay, and you tethered it how high?
Well, we had to modify it. You can't shoot a 50 caliber machine gun up into the sky anymore.
Even in the desert?
The shells can travel up to 9 miles away. So, yeah, we wanted to be safe. But the idea was not, you know, what distance is it going to pop it, but will that balloon, can we measure the rate at which it falls? Because could it stay up at, let's say, a couple thousand feet and take all of this shelling and all these bullets, and then can it fall down? How long is it going to stay aloft? Is it, you know, enough time that their 1,500 rounds are going to be able to shoot at it and still float? So anyways, very interesting. And I thought, okay, well, look, we've added to this conversation. We found that it is possible that you have some sort of debris that could be causing an object to sort of appear. I did not find satisfaction in the weather balloon theory. I thought that was ridiculous.
They didn't have barrage balloons over L.A. like they did over London, did they?
They did have some, but I think what the historians were able to say was out here in Long Beach, they had the aircraft plants, and I don't think the barrage balloons arrived at least for a few months later before they started using them. So that was another popular theory. And, you know, so I kind of thought this story was as far as we could go with it. So here's the kicker. Okay. Along comes a TV show from Canada and called UFOs Declassified. Now, this appeared on the Smithsonian Channel and History Canada. And they said, look, you did this case. We'd like to work with you. And so I ended up hosting a few episodes for them. And one of the shows we did was the battle over L.A. And I said, guys, I think there's really not much more we can do here. But I also knew I had never been to see this actual negative that it's housed at UCLA.
Mm-hmm.
So we arrange it.
This is the one that appeared in the cover of the L.A. Times.
The one that appears in the L.A. Times. So
in 1942, in February.
Uh-huh. Well, as we get there, Simon, I forget his last name, is the curator there at Special Archives. He brings out these slides, and if you've never gone to an archives, it's so fun. It's here you are holding in your hands with, you know, white gloves.
Exactly.
History from so many historic moments. And we had a set of what they call slides, okay, which are basically kind of how the negatives were from that time period, where a photographer who we believed was the actual photographer, because he was mentioned by Bruce Maccabee. His last name was Calvert. We thought, without a doubt, this has got to be the guy, because this slide was found in this man's collection of other photos.
Oh.
But as we took this slide out, we put it on the light tray, we realized that this slide was not the original. There are what we call notch codes, which are little notches within this negative that tell you what kind of film it was produced on. This particular film, as we looked up the notch codes, tells us, it gets a little technical here, but this is a copy of a negative or a positive.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So somebody had taken the negative, made a positive out of it, and then it made another negative out of it.
And why would you do that?
We have no idea. But we
is
do
that a, is that a normal process? And a photographer takes a picture and it appears in the paper. They go through a two-step as opposed to a one-step process?
It would be. If they're doing the touch-ups, which we know occurred, the touch-ups had happened. However, we thought what we had here was the original that had appeared before it was touched up. What we know now is that the LA Times does not have the original photograph, which also means we do not know even who the photographer is, which also means we do not know if other photographs exist, which also means we do not know if somebody had come in shortly after the event, which had actually happened 2 days before this photograph was published, and had taken the original for some reason.
Hmm. Well, now, to substitute it, to make an inter-negative so they could screw around with it so you wouldn't see what was there.
Very possible. And if you were a photographer and you're out there looking at this thing and you've got to have a long exposure delay to take this picture, why? Why would you only take one photo of something so grand and so newsworthy, and you come out with one photo? They maybe only print one photo, but they had their whole collections in there.
So did you go back through the archives and try to find out who the photographer was on staff that night, who was on call, if they had independent, you know, freelancers, who they would have gotten the picture from?
Well, it's funny you ask that, because my good friend David Marler, who wrote a book called Triangular UFOs, he literally wrote the book on triangular UFOs, happens across a yard sale while he was in L.A. And as he's at this yard sale, he finds a photo of the Battle of Los Angeles. And he says,
"What?
Where did you guys get this?" And I said, "Oh, that's my grandfather worked for the Associated Press, and he took that photo." And I said, "Your grandfather took it?" And they flipped it over on the back, and he said, "Yeah, look." And stamped in red, it says Associated Press.
Oh, my.
And
so when you compare the two pictures, what's different in the photo at the yard sale?
It's quite different. Quite different.
Do we have that comparison?
I've got the original photo, the scan that's the really, really big one. There was a lot added in with these searchlights. And
so you think some artist actually kind of just penciled them in that inter-negative process to make it more dramatic?
Yes, which was common in the day, and that was
with William Randolph Hearst, yellow journalism. Yeah, of course.
That was, you know, a Photoshop of the day, which is understandable. However, it just opened another can that we're trying to track down now, because we've been trying to interview this family.
We're at the top of the hour. We've got a 30-second station break. You're on the other side of midnight. My guest this morning is Ben Hansen, and we're discussing the amazing 1942 incident over Los Angeles of something not quite in the Independence Day category, hovered over L.A., maybe, was fired at, definitely, and a whole bunch of mystery still surrounds it, because now, as you can hear, Ben has discovered that the photo that was on the front page of the L.A. Times a couple of days later is not the original. You're on the other side of midnight, and we shall return. Time for cool. Tonight I'm gonna break away just to wait and see. I'll never be. And welcome back to the other side of midnight. My guest this morning, Ben Hansen. We're talking about UFOs. We're going to be talking about UFOs and a certain presidential candidate shortly. But we're going to finish up now on the 1942 apparition of something over the city of Los Angeles that caused a very sleepless night for a whole bunch of people. And if you want to join the conversation, remember, Other Side of Midnight on Facebook, or we're also on Twitter. If you go to theothersideofmidnight.com, that's our homepage, theothersideofmidnight.com, go to the upper left-hand corner of the page. There you will find the icons, the Facebook icon, the Twitter icon, the YouTube, the Google, and all that. So click on Facebook or Twitter, and you can join the conversation. And if you're really, really clever and you send a really clever question in, M will send it over to me, and I will actually try to read it on the air. So, Ben, back on this. So the photo is very different that you found at the yard sale.
Yeah, there are some significant differences with it looks like almost some of the search beams were completely drawn in, which makes sense, because if you look at the photo that appeared in the L.A. Times, there weren't that many searchlight batteries that close together. When we mapped it out, they were miles apart. They tried to do it in a, like every mile, you know, to put one down in a kind of a grid. So the photo's different. And what interests us the most is that now I called up the Associated Press. And I said, look, I don't really understand how this all works, but take me back to the 40s. I said, if there were a photographer that worked for the LA Times, could they also work for the Associated Press? And do you have this photo? And she emailed me back and she said, interestingly enough, this is one that we just barely digitized. And she says, yes.
Wait, did they just barely? You mean they just recently digitized?
Just recently.
Barely sounds like the computer almost didn't want to.
They had recently digitized it and put it in their online collection. And she said, we have this photo. So we confirm it was an Associated Press photo, but we have no information on the photographer.
Isn't that weird? Because there were stringers who used to, you know, hang out and take pictures, and they would try to sell them, the, you know, anything to make a buck. And if you have a major war going on over downtown L.A., and there's howitzers, and there's star shells, and there's like 4th of July in February, there probably would be a few stringers that want to take pictures and sell their photos to the AP, UPI, etc. So I'm surprised there's only one picture. Now you've found what? Two.
That there's only one. And it is, we've lined them up. We believe it came from the same photographer, but it may not have belonged to this Calvert individual that we had believed, the Maccabee believed had taken the photo. It could belong, and his name escapes me at the moment, but these people having the yard sale who said this was their grandpa who took the photo. And so what we're trying to do.
So he could have taken both photos. That's what you're saying.
Well, I think it's the same photo. I just think that it's been, you know, manipulated.
Oh, it may have been the original. Okay, hold it there. We're about 5 after the hour. My guest this morning is Ben Hansen. We're talking again about the amazing events that took place over at downtown L.A. in 1942, half a mile in the sky, and for something that big and that major over a major metropolis, the amount of evidence is very, very, very thin. Gosh, I wonder if they did the same thing they did at Roswell. Went around and took away everything. We shall return.
They paved paradise, put up a parking lot. A pink hotel, a boutique, and a swinging hot spot.
Don't it always yes, Joni Mitchell.
Don't know what you've got till it's gone. It paved paradise, put up a parking lot.
And you're on the other side of midnight, and my guest this morning is Ben Hansen, and we're talking about the famous incident over Los Angeles in 1942, when every gun on the darn basin apparently opened up, and they were firing at something for quite a while, hovering in the skies above L.A. Was it just a hoax? Was it just people who were really trigger-happy because, you know, the Pearl Harbor had happened just a few months before? Or was there, in fact, something? So what's your ultimate conclusion, Ben? Did we fire on something that decided to do something really dumb and kind of hover over L.A. at the middle of people's psychosis?
Well, the military still maintains that it was war nerves. They thought that their men got nervous, and once one starts shooting, they all start shooting. And the historians believe they also put weather balloons up every half an hour was the standard operating procedure, and that they were shooting at possibly weather balloons. I don't think that's very likely. But did we have an actual physical object that was floating in the sky? The case for me is still wide open. The photograph may not be the end all, but that's the lead we're taking right now to see if we can find other photos of the event.
It just seems to me, given the fact that the war was, you know, underway and people were very nervous, and of course the news stringers, as I said before, there was a whole cottage industry of people who would basically look for news and they would sell their pictures, kind of like people sell news stories down to the National Enquirer. So there should be more than one or two pictures of something that went on for so long and was so loud and spectacular. I mean, come on, it was wartime. You'd think people would just ignore it?
The news people especially. This doesn't happen every day. This is gold for them, and the fact that we only have one photographer out there doing this, it just really kind of strange to me. So
okay, let's move the conversation, because obviously it's a 70-year-old case. We're not going to probably crack it tonight. And then someone listening actually says, "Wait a minute, in my attic I've got an old, you know, that kind of thing." Wouldn't that be cool? Amazing. How did you get into analyzing the body language of various politicians now, including the gal who's running for president of the United States, Hillary Rodham Clinton? How'd you get into analyzing body language to see if they're telling us the truth?
Well, as I always do in my videos, which I post if anyone wants to go look at them.
I was going to say, you have videos? Where do you have videos? How can we see your videos?
If you just Google or go to YouTube and just search for Jimmy Kimmel, Obama UFO analysis, or Clinton analysis, my videos will come up under the channel Hypo Center Productions 101, and I could spell that out. But
yeah,
you find the link.
Please spell that out. Hypo Center Productions.
Hypo Center Productions. HypoCenter. Or if you go to benhanson.com, you'll find links from there as well to the videos.
Yeah, and we've got a link to that under your bio at the bottom of your page on theothersideofmidnight.com.
There you go. So you can find the videos right here on your website. There's a couple of them there. And my disclaimer always is this. I do not claim to be a body language expert. I have not written books on it. I do, however, feel that...
But wait. Well, what kind of training as part of the state of Utah or the FBI did you have that would make you proficient in looking at body language?
Well, starting with my degree, which was sociology, criminology, nearly double majored in abnormal psychology, that sort of sparked the interest. When I started working in child sex crimes investigations, I was trained and certified in forensic, what they called intensive forensic interview techniques. So this is interviewing victims and perpetrators of really, really bad crimes. When you get to the FBI and Quantico, basic training is, they'll take you through some of the nonverbal types of things, but it's really just kind of gloss over. The people who specialize in this usually have their degrees in the psychology, but what I did is I had a real personal interest, and I just voraciously would read anything I could about deception techniques and kind of like tricks and stuff to do during interrogations to get people to tell the truth. And so it kind of became a pet hobby of mine until I felt like, look, I may have not written any books about it, but I do know people who have. And I've consulted with them. I've looked at their studies, and I put together what I believe is a very neutral, objective look at some very interesting interviews. And why are our politicians talking about this at this time? Very interesting that we have... first of all, I guess, do you want to start with how it all began with Kimmel?
Yeah, let's do that.
Okay. So if we go back to 2014, as most people know, talking about UFOs and their beliefs in them or aliens, it's kind of a political death nail. We look at Senator Kucinich, who was
poor Dennis, poor Dennis. Oh, and Shirley MacLaine. Oh my God, the humanity.
So during the debates with Obama for his first term. 2007, I think, he had these debates where he talked about his UFO sighting. The moderator, Tim Lassert, had asked him, "So you saw a UFO? Do you believe in aliens or something like that?"
Mm.
Put him on the spot. He did well. He said, "Well, I saw something unidentified and whatever."
Was he in the hot tub with her when he saw it? I forget that part of the story.
That I don't remember. But after that, you don't hear about Senator Kucinich really anymore in the news.
Nope. Death knell. Bad step, Dennis. Don't do that. Don't admit you've seen a UFO. Well, Jimmy Carter admitted he'd seen a UFO, and he became president. So,
Jimmy Carter, you've got President Reagan you know, who witnessed one with Lucille Ball and Nancy on the way to a party.
Wait. Back up. Lucille Ball was in the plane with Nancy and Ronnie when they saw it?
Well, I think we're talking about two different things. I believe they were in a car. Maybe they – I'd have to fact check that. I don't remember if they were driving to Lucille Ball's house.
If they were all together, that raises some – see, this is the reason why you got to go and subscribe to Club 19.5. Because the other night I was talking to another guest and we had a very big deal about Lucille Ball and the reason she did certain things. If she saw a UFO with Ronald Reagan and Nancy, that would explain Lucille Ball's fascination and presentation, basically, Ben, of Star Trek.
Oh.
Without Lucille Ball, we would not have Star Trek. She put so much stuff behind the scenes to make Star Trek against NBC and all that work and work and work. She worked with Gene quietly. They had long meetings. I've been trying to figure out what was it that got her so interested in Star Trek. I mean, you know, think of Lucille Ball. Think of Lucy and Desi. Think of the show. Can you imagine anything farther from Lucille Ball than Star Trek? But if but if you can verify that she saw a UFO with Ronald Reagan and Nancy, that opens up a whole new window into why she was interested when a guy named Roddenberry came in and said, I've got this show called, you know, Wagon Train to the Stars. You interested?
Well, we do know she was fascinated by the story. So I'm referring to your guest you had on, friend of mine, Grant Cameron, Presidential UFOs. So if you go to his site, his retelling of the story is that Reagan, Ronald, and Nancy were going to a party. They were missing from the party. The party had begun and was held up until they arrived nearly an hour late. Now, according to both Lucille Ball and comedian Steve Allen, their version of the story was Reagan was very excited, and he described the fact that he and Nancy had seen a UFO while coming down the coast highway to Los Angeles and stopped to watch the event. So it doesn't look like Lucille Ball was with them, but she's retelling the story because she was at the party. So at any rate.
Wait. So when Ronnie and Nancy arrive, they tell the story, and she's one of the guests at the party, and it makes a big impression on her. So she retells it in later years, right?
Yes.
This tells me that Lucy got excited by something that Ronald Reagan saw in the sky. And that's another set of circumstantial data points as to why Lucy quietly became the reason we got Star Trek.
Wow.
Interesting, isn't it?
Really, really cool connection.
Well, that's the theme of this show. We try to make connections to things that people don't normally think may have connections. So anyway, sorry to interrupt, but that's just too amazing to let that pass.
No worries. So the point is, a few presidents at least have actually stated that they had seen UFOs, and I think even one of the pilots of Obama's Air Force One had reported one. Anyways, you don't hear about this. We hadn't heard about this in mainstream media really up until the point where you've got Carter, who made promises to look into it. Then you don't hear anything from him. And then we have Clinton, who, according to a lot of people who study this, Bill Clinton has looked more into the subject and spoke more about it than any other president previously. So here we have trying to get my dates right, but I believe it was 2014. I want to say it was April. And we have Bill Clinton appearing on talk show host Jimmy Kimmel's program. Now, the little TV I watch, I do love Jimmy Kimmel. I think he's really funny.
So if we're going to radio with pictures, this would be now video number 2, analysis of Bill Clinton's interview on UFOs with Jimmy Kimmel.
That's the one.
Okay.
Now, I might do better probably just summarizing this instead of you scrubbing through.
People can look at them in their own, and you can obviously, again, the reason for Club 19.5, you can watch the video on your own, and all the things that Ben's going to talk about now, you can see when you watch it in your own time frame, again, if you're a member of the club. That's the advantage of being a member of the club. So continue, please.
So make yourself a good bowl of popcorn when you watch these, because I admit they're very lengthy. This segment, Jimmy Kimmel, what we don't know, we've reached out to Jimmy Kimmel's production and have not heard back from him. We would like to know, was this Jimmy's idea or was this the president's idea? Okay, so
now when you say we, is it you or is it you and Kiviat or you and other people?
Well, Grant Cameron has been on these conversations with me. Lee Spiegel of the Huffington Post has reached out.
Okay. Know both of them.
A few people who are really interested in what's developed here. So here we have Bill
Clinton.
But
the Kimmel people have not responded.
No, they haven't. But interestingly, as I talk here, we get to what happens with Obama. We know they're aware of our interest and of the video. Very, very interesting story there. So at any rate, so Jimmy Kimmel comes out a couple days before this interview and says, when I get Bill Clinton on, I'm going to ask him about UFOs and Area 51 and what he did to look into the files. So here we have, obviously, the president now is on notice. Many people believe that all presidents and former presidents have every question scripted. Now, that could be true. I wouldn't say that it's necessarily true, but it makes sense. At any rate, what we see in the reactions of Bill Clinton are even more significant, because knowing that he could have prepared or should have prepared for the questions, we'll start out. I'll just kind of give you my impression of what happened.
Okay.
Bill Clinton in the first segment is really, really jovial. He's laughing. He's gesturing a lot. He's talking about cheese and how he loves cheese and all these funny things.
Hmm.
They take a commercial break, and when they come back, when we're looking at body language and trying to decide if someone is being deceptive, body language is really going to tell you more or less stress levels. It's not going to tell you necessarily that someone is lying. Now, there are indicators that someone is not, that they're omitting truth or twisting truth, but mostly we're looking for changes in a shift in their demeanor and how they are normally. So we have, luckily, lots of material on Bill Clinton, lots of footage of when he's relaxed, and we have a lot of footage of knowing when he tells lies.
I'm thinking of the Monica Lewinsky tape.
And you'll see if you go through that video.
His eyes become dark and beady and tiny. Okay.
So I try to keep all my videos politically neutral. I don't bring in any of my personal preferences in this. And we see here that he shifts his demeanor, because you're going to see him grip the arms of the chair. He crosses his legs. We see a number of things that indicate to me he's closing off. We see...
Now, wait a minute. This is a president who's sitting in that chair because he knows that Jimmy Kimmel, 2 days before on the air, said, I'm going to ask Bill Clinton about UFOs. And when he gets to that part, you say the Clinton's behavior suddenly becomes different.
Suddenly becomes different. So if people look at it later, you would fast forward to about, I think it's about 7 minutes in or so. And he suddenly, what we call he minimizes his gesturing. So throughout the interview, he's using both hands. He's very expressive. People who get nervous, if you think yourself going to a dentist and you sit down in that chair and you're like, oh boy, I'm apprehensive about the pain. What's going to happen? Most people will cross their feet, they'll hold their wrist, they'll put their hands in their lap, very minimal gesturing. And so we not only see this, I'll read off a list of things we see. We see clenching of his jaw. He flexes his jaw a lot. He does it when he's not nervous, but this increases. We see stammering, stuttering. We see muddled speech.
Hmm.
He flounders. Now, Bill Clinton is notorious when he gets stressed or nervous to bloviate. He just keeps talking and talking, hoping that he's going to talk his way out of something and find a thread. He hates the silence. Now, Obama, as we see a little bit later, is very precise and controlled. Very different. We see a couple instances where Bill Clinton, what we call, backs out of the dead-end alley. So, for example, Jimmy Kimmel asks him, and he says, did you look into the UFO files? Did you look? Did you see? Did you explore? And Bill Clinton says something to the effect, he starts out and he says, well, sort of. Hmm. Now, we could spend all day talking about these qualifying phrases and how he doesn't really – he has quasi-denials. He doesn't really answer the questions. But you see him getting mixed up with the chronology. He's talking about Area 51 on one hand and about special clothing that people had to wear before going in there. And then he changes the subject completely. And you kind of get the sense of this is a guy who is he's speaking about things that someone has told him don't talk too much about. He kind of you'll see that he'll starts in and then he changes it, and you leave with a feeling kind of like I have no idea what he was just saying. And when I went and I talked to George Knapp, who of course broke the Area 51 story, none of the facts of what he was saying lined up with what is known about the base. And then he finally comes and says, well, when I had the papers reviewed with Roswell, I had everything reviewed.
This is Clinton.
Clinton, if you look at the story of Roswell, there were no papers. There were no papers.
I thought Stephen Schiff, who was the congressman who launched that probe, the real MacGuffin there was no MacGuffin. There were no papers. They'd all been destroyed. All the cables,
yes.
The whole paper trail had been burned. Yeah. So why is Clinton saying
–
now, is Clinton being too clever by half? Is he saying this so people will trip him up on it and know that he's not telling the truth?
Well, you know, at the end of the day with this interview, because I want to get on to these other really good ones, but at the end of the day, I had made – my conclusion was I don't believe that he is being completely honest. Now, that doesn't mean he knows anything about UFOs.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel that we're sensing either a couple things. Number one, he's been told enough that he was told not to ask anymore. And if you can imagine being a president and being told by someone higher than you that there you are not the ultimate authority of the land, really is a cut to your ego. And I kind of got the sense of his frustration, because you can look at other interviews. For example, I believe it was in Japan, and someone had asked him something about that. Do you think you're being lied to? And he said, well, there have been, it wouldn't be the first time in history where a president's been lied to.
Mm-hmm. A safe phrase. Very safe. Okay, hold it there. We're at the bottom of the hour. 1.5 hour left to go. If people want to join the conversation, there are several ways. You can go to the upper left-hand corner of our homepage and click on Facebook or Twitter and join us that way. Or you can actually call us in the next half hour at 505-796-8802 or on Skype, Enterprise Mission, or The Other Side of Midnight. My guest this morning is Ben Hansen, and we're going to be delving back into analyzing videos, including Hillary. What does the body language say about what does it say? I mean, that's the question. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland, and we shall return.
Build my world around you, darling. This love will shine, girl. Watch it and see. If you give a little more than you're asking for, your love will turn the key. I just want to be your everything. Open up the heaven in your heart and let me be the things you are to me and not some puppet.
And we're coming back. Welcome back, everyone, to the pleasant, dulcet tones of Gretchen Wilson. I wonder, someone must be a country music fan.
Somebody, somewhere must be. My guest this morning is Ben Hansen, and we're talking about, we're talking now about body language and interpreting what presidents and would-be presidents say about this mystique of UFOs. Please continue, Ben.
All right, so let's wrap up talking about Bill Clinton and move on to Obama here. But as you look at the end of this Bill Clinton interview in 2014 on Jimmy Kimmel, after he had finished telling Jimmy that he looked into the files, he didn't find anything, there were no aliens at Area 51, he starts to become comfortable again. You'll see him gesturing. He starts to feel kind of like his old self. Now, he goes on this little monologue about saying, now, I do believe that it's possible there's life on other worlds, and Kimmel's nodding his head and everything. Then you see Kimmel throw him a curveball, and he says, oh, so you're trying to tell us that there are aliens. And suddenly, now, if people look at this, they're going to say, well, you're being very hypercritical. Mm-hmm. Absolutely, I am. If you know anything about body language and you take a look at, for example, Paul Ekman, who was the advisor to the TV show Lie to Me, he developed something called microexpressions. You're looking at very, very minute flashes of a gesture across someone's face that, you know, lasts like a thousandth of a second.
Hmm.
Well, you'll see.
But with HD now and cameras rolling at X number of frames per second.
Precisely. So what I did is I zoom in, and when he asks him, he says, so you're telling me there are aliens. A very inopportune time, Bill Clinton's hand twitches very kind of surprisingly, and he responds, and he says, no, what I'm saying is there is a possibility of life. But as you watch this, he's actually nodding his head yes. Which, you know, when we look at deception, we're looking for incongruencies. Now, one of these things alone, not a big deal, interesting. Two, three, four, when you take them in totality, it paints a picture that I think Bill Clinton is holding something back. Maybe it could be that he had more inquiries. Maybe someone told him to stop. But I don't think he's being completely truthful. So now we fast forward to 2015. For whatever reason, this might be a personal fascination for Jimmy Kimmel.
Mm-hmm.
He has President Obama come onto his show, I believe it was in March, March 3rd or 4th, something like that, of 2015. Now, interestingly, I live here, you know, pretty close to L.A., about an hour or so away. I had heard that Obama was going to be on the show because they closed the 405 freeway, and I didn't think that he would ask him anything about UFOs. I went to sleep. Well, the next morning, I got all these messages, and people said, when are you going to do analysis on Obama? When is this going to happen? I said, what are you talking about?
Hmm.
And when I went to watch the video, I was blown away. Blown away. Within this video, I don't mean to toot my own horn here, but you'll find out that the day prior to this interview, the LA Times did a story on my video of President Clinton's interview.
Oh.
And they said the last time a president was on, Jimmy Kimmel asked Clinton about UFOs, and this is what happened, and Ben Hansen did an analysis, said that he probably wasn't being completely truthful. And that the reporter said, will he ask Obama the same question?
Oh, my God, they set it up for you.
Okay.
Because you know that Kimmel and his production staff avidly, we used to read, when I was at CBS, we used to read the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal and the National Enquirer. It's like you have to, if you're in the news business, you got to do that. So someone knew that putting a story before Obama appears would set it up.
Not only did they know, but shortly into the 50-second was all it was segment about UFOs, Kimmel tells Obama, basically like a lawyer on cross-examination, and he says, now, you know, before you answer this, there are going to be people online who are going to analyze every little movement, every little gesture. He's talking about my video. And I can prove that, not again to be, you know, toot my own horn here, but there was nobody else doing this. I was the only one who had analyzed it.
Hey, Ben, it's called show business for a reason. Come on, take credit. It's obvious that the LA Times set it up. Kimmel obviously knew it was you they were talking about. He uses that to put Obama on the hot seat. What happens?
So the president says, I know, and he chuckles, I know, I know. So they're talking about my video to the president. President knows I analyzed it. And I'm thinking, do I do it now? Can I analyze the president, the sitting president of the United States? And I thought about it for several days. Is this going to get me in trouble? What's going to happen? You know, I finally said, if I don't do it, nobody will. Nobody will. So I did it. It took me several weeks. And what I thought I would, where I thought I would find nothing, with that 50 seconds, it turned into a 36 minute analysis. And if you get a chance to watch this, it doesn't play well on radio, but your listeners, if you go watch this.
This is link number 3, Radio with Pictures, under Ben's items. And the best way to do it is to listen on the archive, 19.5, then play the show, and then play the tape, and then pause the show so you can look at the sections that Ben's going to talk about. Go ahead.
So if you do go to that item number 3 there, and if you fast forward it, well, I suggest you watch the whole thing. Get some popcorn, like I said. But if you move into it, you'll see, you'll see a part where I was looking in high definition video, and I realized, gosh, I wish I could see how fast he's breathing. And lo and behold, when you zoom in high def, I was able to get a breathing rate from the video.
From like what, shirt buttons or the lapel pin or something?
His lapel.
Oh.
So when you look at his lapel, you can clearly see him taking a breath. And there's a video camera angle that shows it for enough time that I was able to get – let me see here what I actually – without getting to the video itself. So – I was able to get 12 to 16 breaths. Okay, 12 to 16 breaths is the average adult. What we measured and averaged out was that in that 10 or 14 seconds, he breathed 10 breaths a minute. In that 14 seconds, which equals 42 breaths per minute.
Oh, my gosh.
Now, that is considered a medical term called tachypnea, which if you were to breathe that quickly over an extended period of time, you would pass out.
That's called hyperventilation.
Yes. Now, he's a smoker.
But he quit quite a while ago, I guess, a year or so ago.
Right. So you might expect some there, but this elevated is different than I'm going to pass out here. Now, the reason he doesn't pass out, I believe, is because this is sort of a psychosomatic, a physiological effect related to stress. When they hook you up to a polygraph, you don't pass out because you had elevated breathing after a certain question, but your body thinks you need the air. So within those few seconds, breathing increases exponentially and then goes back to normal right away. So this video received a lot of controversy because from that point on, we do what's called content statement analysis, and we look at how Obama has treated the subject in the past. So just to briefly give you a kind of summary here, Obama, from his first public statements, if you go back to the debate with Kucinich and everything that happened in 2007, I guess it was. He always treats the UFO subject with derision. He jokes about it like any politician probably would. He dismisses it. You'll see a slow evolution as he becomes president. There's a time he went to visit Roswell, New Mexico. He made a joke about coming in peace. And he said that 9 and 10 year old kids always ask him if the aliens are real, and he tells him if he told him he'd have to kill them. Kind of funny, but not really presidential to tell kids you're going to kill them. It's not until this interview, and you'll see him throw out three quick jokes to kind of laugh about this. And this is what people, regardless of your political affiliation, you have to admit he's a very charismatic guy. And that's why a lot of people like how smooth he is. And as he makes these jokes, there is a shift in demeanor that I believe is as great, if not greater, than what Bill Clinton did a year before. Because he comes out and he says, when he finally corners him, and Kimmel says, look, okay, you know, funny, but people are going to analyze what you're saying now. Did you look? Did you see? Did you explore?
Mm-hmm.
He looks down, he looks to the side, and he says with a stutter, I can't reveal anything. Now, to most people, they're thinking, okay, this is all, you know, part of the joke.
It's part of the shtick.
Yeah. But if you go back and I lay this out and make a case I think was pretty good, and look at all the indicators, I absolutely believe that he is being serious in this part. Now, is he being serious kind of like, hey, I'm the cool kid in school, I know something you don't know, and I really don't know anything? That's debatable. But his response is precise, it is deliberate, and I believe that his action is congruent with somebody who has a serious tone. I can't talk about this. Now, no president has ever said this, and I've checked with all the people who research this, like Grant Cameron and all the people who keep tabs on him.
Grant would know.
Nobody has ever said, I can't reveal anything regarding the UFO subject. Now, talk to Stephen Bassett, of course, and the disclosure movement. Why, if you were president and your administration had come out and said officially, there's nothing to reveal, okay? If they had come out and said that and said, look, there's no cover-up, not only is there no cover-up, we have no evidence of an extraterrestrial connection, or I'm sorry, of a presence. If your administration had officially said that...
Oh, wait. The Obama administration has officially said this through the White House, I forget what it's called. It's the public poll, or what do they call that thing? And they've got
the,
like 100,000...
The online petitions.
The online petitions. Uh-huh. And they've got a huge number of wanted answers. And the White House came out with a very stuffy, very official, very 1940s disclaimer that there's nothing there, move along. So
exactly.
The president is contravening his own White House statement in that petition.
It made no sense. If there's nothing to reveal, you refer back to the previous statement. You know, we looked into that, you know, that we can't find any evidence.
So you're saying that he basically is trying to tell us the truth between the lines.
There's something there to reveal. It would seem as if, again, not saying he personally knows, but you don't just come out and make a statement, like even in an entertainment show. And
as the president of the United States, the leader of the free world, we used to say, the most powerful individual in the history of the planet, and he said,
I can't reveal anything.
See, that's what makes it so newsworthy.
And you know, it goes deeper than that. We get into talking about John Podesta, his special advisor, who now runs Hillary Clinton's campaign. Podesta had his ear for a whole year, and we know Podesta is a big champion of UFO disclosure.
That's putting it mildly.
So if you've got the president's ear for a year, and you're like, hey, Barack, we've got to do something about this. We need disclosure. Need disclosure. He makes these bizarre tweets and comes out at the end of his tenure with him and says his biggest regret of all of 2015 was not obtaining UFO disclosure.
This was Podesta.
Podesta.
Yeah. Hang on a sec. Okay. Darren has joined us, and I think he's got a very important question apropos of the moment. Good morning, Darren.
Good morning. Good show, Ben. This is great.
Thank you.
I guess President Obama can't remove truth's protective layers, huh?
Well, yeah. What we're seeing, I think, is a few presidents, and as we wrap up hopefully in a few minutes with Hillary, you're seeing, I think, frustration from all of these presidents and potentials that they're not the top dog.
Either that or they have to, like, promise not to say anything when they take the office. Or
but that means they're not top dog.
Yeah, that's true.
You can't cut it any finer. Anything else, Darren?
Yeah, I wonder when they're going to ask him about the moon and ancient artifacts. They never ask about that. They always ask about UFOs, and I'd love to hear that just one time. Have they ever asked?
Not that I'm aware of.
You know, I do vaguely remember just recently there was an interview that he gave on to GQ magazine. And if I can find that, I can give you the transcript. There may have been something in the moon about that where he briefly mentions conspiracies. And he may have said something to that effect.
Okay. Hmm. Okay.
Send me the FB question. By the way, if you want to join the conversation, send a note through M. Go to Facebook. That's the quickest way. Upper left-hand corner of The Other Side of Midnight. Click on Facebook, and you can send us a question there. Ben, unfortunately, I can't answer your call because it will put everybody else on hold. I think you may have to update your Skype. So, Darren, was that it?
That's it. Have a good night.
Okay, thanks.
Thanks, Darren.
So let's – all right. Have we wrapped up with Obama?
Yeah, I think we could finish with him. There is another video if you get time to look at number four. He comes on Ellen DeGeneres' show.
Oh, yeah.
So the wrap-up with him is even – oh, it's so fascinating. So, of course, he's talking to this little what they call presidential expert, Macy Hensley. She, I think, at the time was 5 years old or six. At any rate, really cute interview, but – he's talking to her and she says, look, Ellen says, ask the president anything you want. And she says, are aliens real? Mm. And Obama's response is, he stutters again. He says, well, the truth is, Macy, we haven't actually made direct contact yet. Now, a lot of people will say, well, he's talking to a little girl, doesn't want to crush her hopes and all this. But, remember, he's also talking to the American public and to the world. And I can prove, as you watch that video, we do know this interview was completely scripted because they're reading off of cue cards or the teleprompter.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't prepare a statement like that haphazardly. So again, we have a contrary, incongruent statement because now his position is, from I can't reveal anything to now I have revealed that we haven't made direct contact yet. And you could go on for days talking of those words mean.
Absolutely. Well, exquisite Clinton-esque parsing. So speaking of Clinton, drum roll, we have the first candidate for president actually bringing up on her own volition repeatedly and her campaign manager, John Podesta, the concept of UFOs. So what the hell is going on with Hillary, Ben?
Hillary Clinton, as we know, has been fascinated in the subject. We don't need to demonstrate that. The Rockefeller Initiative, which, you know, was her and Bill's kind of push to get things for disclosure. She comes out on Jimmy Kimmel after Podesta's repeated pushing, and he asks her, again, the same question. He says, your husband looked into this. He said he looked into the files and he didn't find anything. Her response, which is, I think it's on here, number one. On the video pictures or radio pictures. She says, well, and she pauses and there's the crowd is like, oh. And she says, I'm going to look again. Okay. And then she proceeds to say how the terminology is no longer UFO. It's called UAP, Unidentified Aerial Phenomenon, which in itself is interesting because she's taking part in culture shaping and changing the nomenclature and how we talk about this, which I agree with. UFO sounds, you know, kooky. And she says, no, we're talking about UAPs. So this is a big interest for her. But the key thing that I have here is not when we get into analyzing whether she knows things or not, I still haven't finished my video yet. But why would you go back to what your husband has done, what your advisor John Podesta said he looked into, your campaign manager who spent all this time says he didn't find any files. What does it say when you now tell the American public, I'm going to look again? It tells them that there's a great possibility this woman believes there are powers greater than she, and that even she and her husband were lied to, and that she has to look again because she's pretty much just merely a puppet when it comes to this subject, which is a scary thought. If you're taking the reins of the country and to know that there is literally a second government or circles of secrets that not even the president of the United States is allowed to know. So we're keeping tabs on this. She has been speaking quite a bit about it. It has made a firestorm of news across the world with the interest. The mainstream media is finally taking notice. If you talk to Stephen Bassett of the Disclosure Movement, he believes there's going to be disclosure possibly as soon as November. I am not so optimistic. I really am not. I don't think we have the leverage. If there are secret keepers, why would they tell?
I've argued with Steve for years, because he and I have this disagreement, he's always telling us it's just right around the corner. And I've said, yeah, it's right around the corner on their calendar. I happen to agree that finally, like a clock that can be right twice a day, I don't want to be deprecating of Steve because he's been in the vineyards a long, long time. But see, the problem when you're dealing with politics is that any excuse can be used to cover up any other excuse. So trying to predict based on normal politics in this realm is frankly impossible. Let me ask you this question.
Sure.
Donald Trump obviously wants to basically ace out Hillary and become president. At least that's what we're all thinking. Why doesn't he use Hillary's UFO predilections mercilessly in a humor which can be devastating? If he does it right, he could destroy her with people that basically already don't like her and are looking for reasons not to like her. In other words, why isn't the UFO card being played against her with an incredible vulnerability by a guy who has obviously no compunctions about using anything? What is this telling us that this card is not being played?
And that's the big debate at the moment. I've talked to Bassett and to Grant Cameron about this. And the belief kind of among the circles is that, whether people like this or not, historically, it's believed that if presidents have been debriefed, Republicans have been given more knowledge than Democrats. They're more defense and war oriented, and perhaps that's the reason. But I'm not saying Trump knows anything. But if there are kind of forces that persuade him, why and could they persuade him to just leave his hands off of it? It's a topic you don't want to touch. It could be something as simple as they looked at the polls and they see that more than half of the people, 60-70%, believe the possibility of been visited already.
Mm-hmm.
Don't offend that base. But who knows? Because Trump can act like a schoolyard bully. And I agree with you. Why not go after the easy, low-hanging fruit?
Exactly.
Go for it. But I don't know. It could be that he has been told it's not a smart move for whatever reason. And we'll have to see where it goes. Because as far as I know, he himself has not made any comments on the matter, despite people trying to get him his stance on it.
See, that's what's also interesting, because behind this facade, as we've discussed on the show many, many times, there's something else going on behind the scenes in the Trump campaign. He's revealing, or the people behind him are revealing, remarkable insights into some amazing things, almost like symbolic clues and messaging. This area, this UFO area, I mean, for instance, I'll give you an example. During the primaries, he blew the doors off Jeb Bush, basically accusing his brother of conspiring to create, the very bizarre response to 9/11 that occurred, that had elements that we're not really aware of. And a couple of days later, Jeb withdraws. He accuses Ted Cruz's father, turns out this is accurate, of being one of the guys handing out leaflets with Oswald in Louisiana, And a couple of days later, Cruz withdraws and doesn't deny that the picture, which we now know is accurately Cruz's father, is Cruz's father. So why isn't Trump, who's obviously used this information, inside information of these candidates against them successfully, why isn't he using the whole problem? And I guess I'm going to have to leave the question there because we're out of time. Ben, thank you so much for being on The Other Side of Midnight.
You're welcome. This has been a lot of fun.
Tomorrow morning, we have open hailing frequencies and some surprises. So until tomorrow morning, just remember, third star on the left, straight on till morning. Good night, everyone.